The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
Today's conversation is about housing. I think it's important to understand the drivers of why Vancouver is so unaffordable and solutions that can actually change the game, that can make it possible for single moms and the over 40% of Vancouverites who spend more than a third of their income on housing to actually be able to afford to live in this place. And today's guest has a plan to fix this problem. Thomas Davidoff, Associate Professor of the Sauder School of Business of UBC, says that it's actually entirely possible for Vancouver to double the amount of people who can live here. And what's more, for us as a city to make billions of dollars doing this. And I want to recognize that today's conversation won't be directly applicable to folks who are hordes off, folks who are living in shelters or tents, but it is very relevant to folks making between $30,000 to $80,000 a year. Here's Tom. Tom Davidoff, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's a real treat. Thank you.
Tom, how large of a factor is speculation? Help me out with assessing the validity of this narrative.
It's problematic for a number of reasons, but I think it's a thought that lots of Vancouverites have.
Here it is. If not for those foreigners putting their money from outside Canada into Vancouver's real estate market, we local folks would have no problem affording homes. How valid is that statement?
Yeah, I think we've learned that's not true. If we said we're not going to let any foreign students study in Vancouver, and if Justin Trudeau said we're not going to let any immigrants into Canada, I think that probably would reduce prices and rents here in Vancouver. I don't think that would be a nice thing to do. I'm an immigrant myself, and I think we should welcome immigration, but it's certainly true that the more people that want to live here, the higher prices and rents are going to be. But sort of foreign people who leave homes empty.
Right. And not folks on the path to immigration. And let's leave foreign students out of this. But let's say, not folks who are going to become Canadian or take permanent residency.
I think what we've learned is there was an impact probably at the highest end of the market. So places like West Vancouver, the wealthier parts of the west side of Vancouver, I think there was, a pronounced impact of affluent foreign buyers. I think for, a not very nice condo in the suburbs, I think the impact was probably pretty limited. And the way we saw that is not long after the foreign buyer tax came in, while the very top of the market was struggling, the condo market got very, very strong. So it is certainly not the case that if we just got rid of foreign buyers who intend to leave properties empty, rents and prices would become quite affordable in Vancouver. That's not true.
Tom, could you step us back a little bit and look at the history of real estate prices in Vancouver? Could you step us back to a time when houses were quote-unquote affordable in Vancouver and how we got to this point?
Well, the ratio of home prices to incomes in Vancouver is extremely high today, and it has been certainly as long as I've lived in Vancouver. I arrived in 2009. When prices were, 50% of what they are today, and they were still considered excessively high. Many people were certain there was a housing bubble going on back then. So, you'd have to go further back in history. People have certainly been complaining about affordability for a long time.
So, talking about that ratio of, I believe it's median assessed value of residential properties in Vancouver to median before tax income. And to my understanding, 2018 Stats Can said that was in Vancouver, the ratio of that was 9-1. And in Toronto, I believe it was 5.7-1, again, 2018. And to my understanding, again, that the ratio we are aiming for is something like 4-1, and anything above that is considered unaffordable. So really, how is it realistic for us to put in government policies, whatever policies or increasing supply or whatever we do? Is it actually possible, in your opinion, for Vancouver to go back to the point where that ratio is something like 4-1?
Well, the most important thing that would help that would be if interest rates were much higher, and that's not going to happen, right? When interest rates are very low, the real cost of owning a home, the price isn't a great measure because you're going to sell the house too. So the right cost is, I've got a bunch of money tied up in the house, I owe a mortgage, and my equity, I'm not earning a return on that financially because it's in the house. So if it costs $1 million and the cost of money is 2% a year, then really the right way to say it is, you know, in essence, that house costs 2% of $1 million is $20,000 a year. So really the best measure of affordability is rent to price, is rent to income rather. And, you know, rent to incomes are bad here, but they're not nearly as bad as we look on price to income. And the reason is the ratio of prices to rents in Vancouver is very high. And that's probably A, because of the low interest rates generally, but also in Vancouver, we expect prices to grow over time. So when you buy a property in Vancouver, you're not rewarded with a high rent today. What you're rewarded with, you hope, is price growth down the road. So again, rent to price is a better measure of affordability. You know, low income people who we care about the most in terms of their housing needs, they're not buying places, they're renting. And so, you know, I think we want to again look at rent to price. And again, it's not great, especially, you know, if you're struggling here in Vancouver. I mean, even on $100,000 a year, I don't think it's particularly easy to raise a family in a rental. And if you're making $30,000, you know, to a minimum wage earner or something like that, $30,000 to $50,000, you know, very challenging when you're looking at $2,500 to have a decent place that's family sized.
Do you happen to know off the top of your head, Tom, what ratio of rent to income we're looking at right now, and what the goal is?
Well, affordability. Yeah, people think 33%. You know, about a third is a comfortable ratio. So if you're making $100,000 and you're paying, you know, $3,000 a month, you're on the limit of what's affordable. If you're making $50,000, then, you know, even $1,500 a month is tough. And again, if you have to pay $2,500 a month, you know, at the lower income range here in Vancouver, that's very challenging.
So Tom, I see a lot of hand wringing almost of folks saying that, well, this is Vancouver is a global city. This is what globalization looks like. It's sort of what it is. The rest of us can move to, you know, Chilliwack or further if we the rest of us who are just don't have that kind of income. What do you say to that? Do you think that is realistic, unfortunate but realistic, or do you think it is actually possible to move back to a place where regular people can live here comfortably?
Well, in the long run, if you think borders are pretty open, why would you get to be somebody with a, you know, not great income and have a nice home in a beautiful place with great climate? I mean, think of how many people in developing countries would kill to have a one-bedroom apartment in Vancouver with clean air, access to beaches, right? So, you know, no way you're getting like a single detached house in a convenient location on a middle-class income here. I just don't see how that's a plausible
future. I mean, even not single detached homes, but even something smaller.
Well, exactly. And that's where policy comes in, and we have the opportunity to do so much more. People don't appreciate just how restrictive our zoning is. So 70% of the city of Vancouver is what used to be single family zoning. Now you can do a duplex and a laneway house, but you're still only looking at, you know, maybe 3,000 square feet on a lot, and you ought to probably have about 6,000 square feet. So the city of Vancouver could very easily double the square footage in its residential neighborhoods, and then some. Of course, if you built apartments rather than townhomes, you can do quite a bit more. If you look at the suburbs, they're all, you know, a lot of their land is large lot, single family. And I don't think, you know, it's crazy. Imagine the government, which claims to care about affordability, allowing communities to exclude something like 90, 99% of the population, right? The west side of Vancouver, you know, a single family home, a new one would be $3 million. So you're saying you're not allowed to build anything. And what, you know, if you think about affordability, you're talking about locking out, I don't know, 95, 99% of the population can't afford that. So that a government would take so much land and deprive people who work for a living from the ability to live there, it's really stunning. And, you know, you listen to some of the people who oppose allowing more affordable forms of housing, and it's unconscionable, really, I think, to say, I have the right to say, I couldn't afford today's prices, you know, if it was just a living, if I hadn't bought in years ago, but I want to pull up the drawbridge and deny that opportunity to newcomers. I really think it's an outrage.
I want to dig in more into that, Tom, because so I grew up in Singapore where the entire place is apartment buildings. And I'm not saying that we should have a city of all apartment buildings, but one thing I've never gotten is why is it that we have so much of the city zoned single family?
You know, think about somebody who lives in a single family home. They're a homeowner, which means they're more likely to
voter
participate
opposition.
In
so
politics.
Is there another reason? I would love there for it to be another reason effect, aside from the fact that, you know, there are NIMBYs, many, many NIMBYs in Vancouver.
No, there's no good reason. And I mean, you know, if you think about housing affordability, that's a great reason to add density. But how about we're supposed to be environmentally friendly? Well, having people live in large homes that need a lot of heat, and because they take up a lot of land to fit the same population, everybody moves out to the suburbs and drives, it's an environmental horror show. So, you know, environment is another reason added on top of housing affordability that we should have more density. No, the only reason is because policy is dominated by homeowners who are more affluent and influential and more tied to the community than renters are on average, right? Owners are more likely to vote, more likely to contact their city council person. And look, it's not unreasonable. If you have trees next door to you today, you will be worse off if there's people replacing the trees. Who would want that? Now, the other side of it, though, is if you look at like the Cambie corridor, when they upzoned, a $3 million house increases in value to $6 million when you're allowed to build at reasonable density. So maybe if it isn't compassion, greed can be a motivator to change land.
So is the solution to increasing affordability in Vancouver, does that lay solely at the feet of city council then? So it's not so much provincial, it's not so much federal, because lots of governments like to push the blame or responsibility around.
Of course they do. Look, homelessness is a different matter. Severe poverty, drugs, I think a provincial or a federal role is important. But even zoning, you know, the rules of the game are written by the province. So municipalities live under the Local Government Act, and Vancouver lives under the Vancouver Charter, and they say, you do the zoning, that's not our issue. And you get into what I would call a prisoner's dilemma. It's a prisoner's dilemma situation. We all want an outcome where there's lots of affordable housing, but we don't want it in our own municipality. Put the affordable housing somewhere else. So if I'm at a city council hearing in West Vancouver, you know, and I say, well, we should provide affordable housing for everybody in Greater Vancouver, the voters who almost overwhelmingly own homes who show up at the council hearing are going to say, forget that. Why don't you let North Van be the suckers who build the affordable housing? So you have a free rider problem. And the solution is for the provincial government to say, sure, you know, local authorities, they know the community best. They can have a lot of influence over land use, but it's got to be within reason. If you're egregiously restrictive, we're not going to give you that authority anymore.
Tom, I know that you've pushed policy proposals to government before, looking at property taxation. And I'm curious if you've looked at zoning at the city level and found ways to make it more palatable for politicians to sell up zoning.
No, I appreciate the question very much so. So, you know, Vancouver and Burnaby have made a fortune selling zoning. So not only do homeowners get rich when you say, well, what used to be single family can now be multifamily. Not only do owners get rich, but the city gets rich as well because they charge these community amenity contributions. So if you build a condo tower, that could be worth many millions of dollars to change the zoning so that instead of just a couple of houses, you can build hundreds of houses. So developers pay the city a lot of money. Well, you can take that money, you can build beautiful libraries, you can improve roads, bike lanes, but even better, ideally, you know, you'd give a lot of that money to people who are struggling and are going to wind up homeless if they don't get some kind of cash benefit.
So to make sure I understand, you're saying take somewhere like Shaughnessy, not saying that folks in Shaughnessy would like it, but take somewhere in Shaughnessy, say instead of single family homes, as a city council, we're deciding to make this townhomes or apartment buildings or what have you. And I'm Mr. or Mrs. or Miss Developer that comes by and says, I want that. And then the city says, great, you have to pay for us to change the zoning and for the right to build in that land.
Correct. That's exactly right. And Shaughnessy would be probably one of the first places I'd rezone. There are some beautiful mansions there that are historically interesting and important. And of course, I think for the really special architecture, you should say, you know, if you want to build, you have to build around it. People still need to be able to see these homes. I mean, a lot of them are buried by trees, so useless to the population anyway. But, you know, I think, you know, and preserving trees, of course, is an important goal. But generally, I think Shaughnessy, I mean, you've got one family on, what, a 10,000 square foot lot. It's crazy. That's a terrible waste of land. So that would probably be the first place I'd rezone.
So why is this so politically impactful? I mean, we've talked a little bit about that. But, you know, I can see it seems plausible that someone comes along in city council and says, well, let's sell up zoning and then increase our city budget, expand revenues to the city by billions, not good billions, but many millions.
Well, yes, billions. Absolutely billions.
How much? How much are we?
Well, I mean, let's take an abstract number. Suppose that, when things were really hot, every condo, every 1,000 square foot condo you built was making you $1 million above construction cost. And suppose you could build 1 million of those throughout Greater Vancouver over 20 years. So 1 million times 1 million is $1 trillion. So the number is extremely large. It's a very big fraction of the Vancouver city budget. Burnaby is sitting on, I believe, in the billions of dollars. No, it's a really, really big number.
So why not? That seems like it could be a half plausible political sell.
It has happened, of course. The Cambie corridor did get rezoned. Slowly but surely, the city will get rezoned. If the stakes are that high, it's going to happen. You know, I it's hard for me to say why people haven't tried harder to sell this to the public. You know, I don't know.
But you see, you see the only barriers to, or you see the only problems with the proposal being the political sell. Other than that,
yeah, I mean, it's a home run. I've never talked to anybody with a good grasp of economics who said that's a bad idea.
I want to close off with just looking at the world as it is. I'm thinking about the Broadway and Birch project. I believe it was 258 units in total. It was a condominium project, lots of opposition to it. And I believe 20%, I think it worked out to something like 58 units were deemed, quote unquote, affordable. Affordable to who? I don't know, because the rents, the prices were still pretty expensive. Would you vote for a project? If you were sitting on city council, would you vote yes or no to that Broadway and Birch project?
Well, you know, the height is a tricky one. I think a lot of the so-called yes in my backyard crowd, which I, you know, mostly identify with, would totally deny that tall buildings create a disamenity. You know, they'd say, I'm sitting in my home today, and if there was a 40-story tower next to me, that would be just as good as a two-story home with trees next to it. I think that's a bit of a stretch. You know, so, you know, how much height we should tolerate, I don't know exactly. One guess, though, would be the Sinaqua development by the Burrard Bridge. Because the problem is, you know, at Birch, the developer's only looking out for himself. He's a good guy, you know, I think, from what I know of him. But, of course, he's going to try and make as much money as possible and build a building. And the height will be determined by, if it gets too tall, it's too expensive to build, and I won't be able to get rid of all the units. So what you'd like to know is, suppose you had somebody that was trying to maximize not property value on one parcel, but on a lot of parcels that are near each other. And the best example we have is Sinaqua.
And that's the one owned by Squamish Nation.
The Squamish Nation, exactly. And they're building something like 50-story towers. Now, the average over the whole area is a floor-space ratio of 10. I think this project, even though it was, you know, however many stories at Birch, I don't think it was 10 FSR because, you know, you take the whole lot and not all of it's built on and stuff.
Sorry, FSR, Tom.
Floor-space ratio, the ratio of built space to lot. So if you have a 10-story building, that might only be a 5 floor-space ratio because not the whole lot goes up that high because you have circulation areas and stuff and alleys and lanes and access and sidewalk. So, you know, 10 seems to be, if you're even recognizing, well, if I build a tall building here, it'll cast shadow over here. They still thought something like floor-space ratio of 10 was optimal. What I've tried to communicate to council is that's our best guess. So if you have a project that's 4, you know, even if your goal is to maximize land value, which I think we should be a little bit more on the side of affordability and building more rather than less in that way, even then, if you're building only 3, 4, 5 stories, there's no way that's the best use of land, even recognizing the negative potential spillovers on neighbors. So my recollection is Broadway and Larch was below that threshold, and it's such a great piece of real estate that I think it should be developed very intensely. What I would not have done again, though, is I wouldn't have made any inclusionary affordability requirement on site. I think that's a terribly inefficient way to help low-income people with rent. You don't give them a brand new unit that, if it was sold as a condo, would go for over $1 million, right? Suppose the discounted rent is only worth over the lifetime of the unit $300,000, and you could sell it for $1 million. Well, then you're essentially holding a lottery, because everybody's going to want that unit, but only a few people are going to get it. So you're holding a lottery for $700,000 prizes. That's a terrible way to help people in need. Better, let the developer build whatever he wants. A lot of the units are going to be rented anyway, even if they're condos, because investors, as we discussed, tend to buy units. So you would let him build whatever he wants, charge him as much as he's willing to pay, and take the cash and help the homeless, write checks to people or give tax refunds to people who make less than $20,000 a year or whatever you decide is eligible for assistance. And then you can help a lot of people a little. Helping a very small number of people a lot. I mean, imagine if Trudeau said, well, you know, we've got these problems with COVID, so we're going to hold lotteries and everybody who's out of work can play in a lottery where if you win, you get $1 million and if you lose, you get nothing. You know, everybody say that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. But somehow when we do it with housing, people think it's a good way to play. I don't.
So maybe connect the dots for me, Tom. My last question for you is, sure, with the city's Rental 100 program, yeah, to my understanding, a program that allows developers to extra features in exchange for rental purpose, yeah, rental units, and then concerns from city council is that some of these rental units, many of these rental units built under this program, their rents are very, very high, are not what the city would like to be, to have considered affordable. What do you think of the Rental 100 program?
Well, again, I basically think it's wasteful. I think let people build whatever they want to build and charge them a lot of money. And instead of forcing developers to put the affordable units in the best location in brand new buildings, which is what new projects are, let those be free form tenure, let them be condo, let them be rental, put in the empty homes tax and speculation tax so somebody uses them. That's what absorbs demand at the top of the market, which is great because that takes pressure off the rest of the market. But to support the bottom of the market, you use cash gained from selling those rights to build. Otherwise, you wind up having these poor doors and lotteries for giant prizes. And I think that's a pretty dumb way to do policy. I don't know why people don't see that, because it seems pretty obvious to me. I mean, if you're going to help people with assisted housing, you're not giving them brand new units worth $1 million. And I don't mean to be mean, right? But, you know, like, there's a lot of people who work very hard and don't get to get $1 million brand new units. So why?
Right. I think what you're saying is we want people to live well. We want folks who need a unit to have a unit, but it doesn't need to be a unit in prime space.
I'd rather help three people with not great units than one person with an awesome unit.
Tom, hey, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate all your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Great interview.
Take care, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And that was Tom Davidoff, Associate Professor of the Sauder School of Business of UBC. And Tom says it's entirely possible to make Vancouver much more affordable than it is now. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. And please tell us what you think of the show. I'm curious. I'm at meixi@coopradio.org. That's meixi@coopradio.org. Take care.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.